the headlines, a twin suicide bombing hits a crowded market in the Iraqi capital Baghdad, leaving at least 28 people dead and over 70 others injured. Anti-establishment protesters in the U.S. cities of Portland and Seattle vandalized several buildings and scuffled with police on President Joe Biden's inauguration day. And the U.S. President Joe Biden signed 17 executive orders just hours after taking office, dismantling decisions made by his predecessor. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour, two bomb blasts have rocked the center of the Iraqi capital, leaving nearly 30 people dead in the first such attack in years. The explosions ripped through a crowded market near Tayaran Square in central Baghdad. According to security sources, two attackers wearing explosive vests blew themselves up among shoppers. Over 70 people were also injured in the attack. There has been no immediate claim of responsibility. Suicide bombings have been rare in the Iraqi capital since the defeat of the Daesh terror group in 2017. Elsewhere, supporters of former U.S. President Donald Trump have clashed with police in the city of Portland, Oregon. Police fired tear gas to disperse demonstrators that included anti-establishment activist protesters, smashed windows of the local Democratic Party headquarters, and later targeted the Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility. Anti-government protesters also took to the streets of the city of Seattle. Police said multiple sites were vandalized. Protesters rejected U.S. election results and said there was widespread fraud in the November vote. U.S. President Joe Biden has signed 17 executive orders to undo Donald Trump's policies hours after taking office. The orders target the former president's policies on immigration, climate change, racial equity, and the handling of the coronavirus pandemic. The actions initiate the process of the United States rejoining the Paris Climate Accord and include the revocation of the presidential permit granted for a controversial oil pipeline. In another order, Biden ended the travel ban Trump put in place on some Muslim-majority countries. The new president has also made compulsory wearing masks in all federal buildings and land. The president's move comes following his inaugural address in Washington, D.C.
Democrat Joe Biden has been inaugurated as president of the United States, replacing the highly controversial Donald Trump. As a result of entrenched but minority perceptions of electoral fraud, there was not a peaceful transfer of power. The nation's capital was locked down into a fortress with more soldiers than the U.S. uses to occupy both Afghanistan and Iraq. State capitals were similarly swarming with troops nationwide. The inauguration is being called a merciful conclusion to an electoral campaign which seemingly started the day after the election of Trump in 2016 and then the most divisive vote in recent memory. Biden's inaugural speech spoke often of unity and reconciliation, but Democrats and Republicans seem to have been at each other's throats for four consecutive years. How to turn off this mutual animosity may be the most urgent problem Biden faces, but it may also be the most difficult.
47 years of Biden's being in politics, that he would actually be able to do what's necessary to heal the country. This is like, unless of course there's some shift in how he sees it, and unless of course there's pressure from the left, like I said, the role of labor, to actually pressure to actually improve the quality of life of working people.
Biden inherits an America which may be at its lowest point in history. America in 2020 combines 1930s economic depression, 1960s cultural division, 1860s concerns with white supremacy, and 1780s questions of political legitimacy. The coronavirus is killing Americans faster than ever. A highly divisive Senate trial of the recently impeached Trump looms. Gun sales and murder records were recently recorded nationwide, and the country remains on high alert for acts of political terrorism, to name a few of the worst problems.
if we're not talking about enacting changes that could improve the quality of life immediately, materially for working people, then I don't think that they'll be able to heal. And I'm talking about like Biden is talking about return to normal. Well, what's normal?
Both Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are considered to be on the right wing of the Democratic Party. Biden's cabinet is filled with holdovers from the era of Barack Obama, during which Biden was the vice president. Kamala Harris has become the highest-ranking woman ever in American history. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Iran has opened West Asia's largest refinery to process flare gas at its oil and gas production sites. In a virtual ceremony marking the event, President Hassan Rouhani said the opening of the mega project proves the failure of U.S. sanctions and its so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. The Abid Bolan Persian Gulf refinery in southern Khuzestan province will play a significant role in expanding Iran's downstream petrochemical sector. The facility is fed by the gas recovered from the supergiant South Pars and Al-Ajari and Al-Az fields. It will add 48 million cubic meters of methane per day to the national gas distribution network. That's beside the production of 1.5 million tons of ethane and 1.5 million tons of liquefied gas a year. The project is part of a major plan to contain 90% of gas flaring at Iranian production sites. The U.S. COVID-19 death toll has surpassed the total American military fatalities from World War II. The Johns Hopkins University reported that nearly 406,000 people have died from the disease caused by the new coronavirus in the United States. According to the Department of Veterans Affairs, the total number of combat and non-combat deaths in the Second World War was almost 405,400. The U.S. is the worst-hit country in the world by the virus, with more than 24.4 million cases. The coronavirus continues to rage through Europe as several countries have reported more deaths and infections from the pandemic in the past 24 hours. Russia reported nearly 22,000 new infections, with over 3,000 in the capital, Moscow. The figure brings the country's total caseload to over 3.5 million. It also reported 612 new deaths, pushing the total to more than 67,000. Germany's Robert Koch Institute also announced more than 20,000 new cases and over 1,000 fatalities in the same period. More than 2 million people in Germany have so far been diagnosed positive, and nearly 50,000 have lost their lives. German officials have extended the country's partial lockdown amid growing fears over the spread of more infectious COVID variants. Northern Ireland says it's facing food supply problems after Britain's departure from the European Union. Irish Foreign Minister Simon Coveney has blamed the disruption in supplies on a certain amount of checks and goods going between London and Belfast. He said the scenario is clearly a Brexit issue, since supermarket shelves were full before the winter holidays. The disruptions are also caused by truck drivers who are arriving at British ports without appropriate documentation. The British government has so far downplayed any interruption in commercial activities after Brexit. England, Scotland, and Wales left the EU single market, but Northern Ireland stayed on. The bloc began applying its customs rules at British ports at midnight on January the 1st. News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. Stay tuned. On this news review, the United Arab Emirates has reportedly signed a deal with the U.S. for 50 F-35 fighter jets, despite concerns about the Arab country's involvement in a deadly and devastating war on Yemen. Reports said the agreement was signed to about an hour before President Joe Biden was sworn into office. The UAE also signed a separate agreement to buy up to 18 armed drones. However, the new U.S. president has said he will re-examine the agreement. The administration of former President Donald Trump had approved $23 billion in stealth-capable F-35 jets, Reaper drones, and other weapons to its Persian Gulf ally after it agreed to recognize Israel. The UAE is a member of the Saudi-led coalition that has been engaged in the years-long war on Yemen, which faces the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have political analyst Mohammed Obey joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also, we have historian and journalist Brecht Jonkers joining us from Hanselt. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Obey in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mr. Obey, what do you have to say about this deal and also about the timing of when it was signed?
Well, first of all, the timing indicates that there will be some changes, although one should not be exaggerating as for the era of Trump versus the era of Biden. But the rushing to sign the agreement a few hours before the inauguration of Biden indicates that there will be some complications regarding those people who were regarded as the favorite allies of the former President Trump. I mean by this the Gulf state countries that rushed also to normalize with the Israelis in order to gain the to be pleasing the U.S. administration. So this is on the one hand. On the other, also, we can understand that the course of the American support of the huge, atrocious genocide that's taking place in Yemen will not be business as usual, as was the case with the former administration. And this is not due to the fact that the new administration is rather better or something, but the issue with the Trump administration and himself personally was that he cared nothing about whatever the whole world would say about this. The issue with this administration is that we will have the usual hypocrisy of the American administrations, that we are for human rights, that we are for not hitting civilians, etc., etc., but at the same time they will be backing the Saudi aggression against Yemen, but without declaring this in public and without selling arms in public, etc.
Mr. Jonkers, what do you think about the timing? Mr. Bates says there will be some changes between U.S. administrations, but not too much to expect.
Yeah, I think that there is a combination of factors at play here. I mean, number one, of course, being that Donald Trump has always been a very vocal supporter of the, you know, the U.S.-backed satellite states, let's call them, in the Persian Gulf. In the wider region of the Middle East. And most importantly, of course, he has been an avid supporter of Saudi Arabia to an extent that has never been openly seen before in any U.S. administration before. Indeed, as the other guest pointed out very, very correctly, Donald Trump didn't really care much about how it would be perceived. He was willing to play openly dirty in order to make sure that that nobody would even dare to examine, you know, the dirty politics of Mohammed bin Salman and Mohammed bin Zayed in the UAE. But the second part, I think, that is on at play here is it's not just, of course, the United States selling more modern weaponry to the UAE. That by itself is not necessarily surprising, especially since Abu Dhabi just recognized the Zionist entity not so long ago and was expecting some sort of reward for this. But secondly, why did they do it an hour before the official inauguration? This, just like many other things that were done by Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo in the last week, for a big part also has, I believe, a domestic value to it. This is basically a bully tactic in order to put more pressure on Joe Biden and make his work more difficult. This is the same thing and the same reason why Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo have decided to allow U.S. politicians to have official contacts with the breakaway state of Taiwan, which is, according to, you know, some reactionaries, considered to be an independent country, but in reality, by most of the world, is considered to be a rogue province of China, of course. This is also the same reason why they decided to designate Ansarullah in Yemen as a quote-unquote terrorist organization, and are basically blocking all humanitarian aid soon, from the United States or any other nation that wants to deal with the United States to help food provisions towards Yemen, because sending food to Yemen can be considered helping a terrorist organization now. These things, for a major part, I believe, are done just to make the work for the Democrats harder, just to make it harder for the Biden presidency to do even the slightest bit of good if they wanted to do so. I believe, indeed, we shouldn't be too positive about Joe Biden either. He is a system politician. He is a right-wing Democrat. But even the few things that he might want to change have been made hard enough by these last-minute changes by the Trump administration. This is a very typical childish play on politics that is so difficult for the United States.
Mr. Obaid, what about the normalization deals with the Israeli regime? We know that the United Arab Emirates stepped forward and agreed to normalize ties in a deal that was sponsored by the United States. In your opinion, the purchase of the F-35 fighter jets part of the exchange as well?
Yes, it helped in this the overall rhetoric that the American administration and all the American administrations would like to say that it would be rewarding to have peace with Israel, to normalize ties with Israel, to forget that this entity was based on aggression. It was based on the tragedy of millions of Palestinians who are now displaced in countries that are not their country. So if you normalize with Israel, look what you can get. You can get better weaponry. You can get better lives, if you will, if the economic flourish is the real thing in the UAE, although many say it's only a mere bubble that would just explode in the first hardships that they may face. So this serves in this purpose, but if you go deep into the real situation of the United Arab Emirates, what would the F-35 do to them? I mean, they have launched all possible aggressions and all atrocities possible against the Yemeni people, who have proven through their steadfastness that it is possible to fight the mightiest of forces if you are convinced that you are on the right side and you are defending your right, no matter whether the world's superpower is standing behind the aggressors. I mean, the United States administration supporting the Saudi aggression and the Emirates aggression against the Yemenis, but still their steadfastness has been surprising the whole world. So F-13s or drones or armed drones or whatever, this will change nothing in the current equation, which has been proven throughout the past four decades in our region, that if you are willing to sacrifice, if you are willing to resist the unjust powers, you will be the party victorious in the end.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Historian and journalist Brecht Yonkers joining us from Hasselt. Also thanks to political analyst Mohammed Obaid speaking to us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. With that, brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. But do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here on Dubai for Now. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Whose Streets, directed by Sabah Folayan and Damon Davis. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Whose Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the US state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
Ferguson police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in the area have some experience with police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars, riot gear, and canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's going to be any change, it starts with our children.
This is going to be my fighter right here. Come here.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves who express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Streets?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. Mm-hmm. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot footage on people's phones and their own private cameras right on the streets in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed, because the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Richard was saying, it is an incredibly big topic with lots of layers, especially on the issue of racism, police brutality, and American gun violence, and so forth. Leek, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films, and why are they important?
I think it's an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalized racism, and that part, you know, it forms an essential documentary narrative around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. Mm. But as we know, the African-American community have been plagued by police brutality for decades. Mm. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that by the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones, gives this a unique feel because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who captured various scenes, and they've tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and the Black Lives Matter all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seemed very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves were so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African-American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and color pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964, yeah. And that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Yeah. Rich, so one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a, quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, on the one side, it shows how these people just come to the streets just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the streets with, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, you know, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, you know, snipers on the tops of these giant tanks that are rolling into the streets. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this. The police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. Mm-hmm. They start off with a quiet vigil. It's a candlelight vigil. And their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them. And the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also that Martin Luther King is quoted, yes, as saying the riots is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a liberal democracy in supposedly, you know, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized, and to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same, and I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them of any military in the world for use against civilians.
And it's exactly the point that you raised that actually, because in the film we see an American Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look at the administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak. But then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. The way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comments that they make to the cameras.
But they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, Lee, you wanted to quickly add something?
I think what it also hints to is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America about the nature, scale of racism and what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism as it affects African Americans, Latinos, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I don't think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on and is fighting.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that
we
racial inequality.
We did see a lot of white people in the crowd in support of the Black Lives Matter.
No, absolutely, and I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse over every single measure. And so a rhetorical understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there. We'll continue this, just taking a break now.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, you know, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop watch sticker on there. Got some walkie-talkies. It's two of them for me. So when I leave, I get one of my wife. So the cops don't come in Canfield, like, no more, like, doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff. And that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. You know, don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera. That's my weapon, you know. And the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
We saw David there with the Cop Watch Initiative. He's quite an endearing and inspirational character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I like the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is invaluable in you know, making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually, to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, you know, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy that targeted poor blacks. And they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile as
portrayed in the film? Well, because the mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. You know, they didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, you know, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. They covered the wrong story.
And Lee, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster post there, where the mainstream media descended on a community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. New technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that monitorium of silence that we've had for so long and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time, and the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take
as long as it's filmed.
from a discussion.
Good evening. My name is Bernie Frazier, and like all of you all, I'm a Ferguson resident. There are a lot of people in Ferguson who have become very fearful of living in this community. But I would like to help you understand one thing. There are many people who have only been fearful for 2 months. There are more people who have been fearful for 2 decades.
It must have been very awkward for the black police officer to be in that situation, probably feeling very conflicted. I just want to read a statistic about U.S. deaths by police gunfire. And by the Washington Post, it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017, and it's on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the U.S.?
I think it's largely because of the failure of U.S. Justice system to deliver, you know, equitable justice for people who suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. We've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017, those are the numbers you expect in a small war, somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is, it's a Jim Crow-style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. Mm-hmm. But then every investigation into every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to, you know, I mean, everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you know, like mm-hmm. you were saying, it's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal, yep, 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of, you know, oppressive policing and, yeah, and marginalization, and mm-hmm. and it's you know, it's that system that's carried on, and
seems that
we're now
to her
people
head.
Are just now saying we're not going to put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have, yeah, Donald Trump,
oh, no,
who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that, yeah, the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role, Lee, in race relations and police brutality?
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man in chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption, found its way to the top job in the United States. It's a disgrace for the country. It's a threat to the world, and it is emboldening and enlivening fascists and racists all over the world. So when Donald comes to the United Kingdom, I expect the whole of the European alt-right to turn out to counter any demonstrations we must put out. That's how dangerous this man, yeah, is in the world.
I'm afraid we'll have to end on that powerful note, Lee. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام ثلاث لا يزيد الله بهن المرأة المسلم إلا عزا: الصفح عمن ظلمه، وإعطاء من حرمه، والصلة لمن قطعه.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "There are three things through which Allah only increases the Muslim in honor: his pardon of one who has wronged him, his giving one who has deprived him, and his reconciliation with one who has cut him off."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find in the historical texts that there is a very special conversation between Jabir al-Ju'fi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now, just to put this conversation into context, Jabir al-Ju'fi is no ordinary companion. He is one of the faithful companions of Imam al-Baqir, and he also happens to be one of the most knowledgeable students and faithful students of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. So this individual is greatly esteemed and has a high status in Islam. And on the other hand, we have Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, of course, who is the divinely appointed Imam, endowed with divinely appointed knowledge. In this conversation between the two, we find that at one point Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says to Jabir, "There is no hope like the helping hope." Now, just to explain this a little bit, there is no hope better than, no aspiration better than, no yearning better than, no positive desire better than the positive desire, the aspiration, the yearning, and the hope which helps. And so the hope which helps us to do what, dear friends? The hope which helps us to become better human beings, the hope which helps us to become righteous servants of Allah, the hope which helps us to become perfect human beings, the hope which helps us to help humanity, to serve humanity, to work for the cause of peace and justice, the hope which helps us to serve the cause of humanity. and truly the best hope, the hope which helps us to get closer to Allah. And so surely it makes sense, and it is true now that we reflect a little bit upon this statement of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, that there is no hope better than the hope which helps. And as we said, the hope which helps us to get closer to our Creator, Allah, the Almighty, the Exalted, glorified be He. Beautiful, spiritual, profound words found towards the end of this conversation between Jabir al-Ju'fi and Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
When you look at the date of the birth of Imam, first of Rajab, in the year 57 AH, this tells us that Imam al-Baqir is known as Tabi'i. In the descriptions of Muslims who are at the time of the Holy Prophet, as we know, they are known as Sahaba, companions of Rasulullah. The generation which came after the Sahaba are known as Tabi'in. Imam al-Baqir is known as Tabi'i because he was born 46 years after the death of the Holy Prophet. If you look at the death of the Holy Prophet was 11 AH, he was born 57, so around 46 years. And he was born 40 years. Imam Amir al-Mumin died in the year 40 AH, so Imam al-Baqir was born 17 years after the death of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Imam Hassan died in the year 50, and Imam al-Baqir was born in 57, so Imam Hassan was not there. But at the time of Imam Hussein, Imam al-Baqir was born and Karbala happened in the year 61. Imam was born on the 57 AH, so he was at least 3 or 4 years of age in Karbala. When you look at that and then you imagine a young boy of 3 or 4 years of age in Karbala, you can see that that left a big mark in his life, because for him to be there to see the massacre in Karbala, it was not easy.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.